Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to Made by Mamas, the podcast. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Georgia.
And we're here talking all things parenthood, tips and tricks,
products we love,
and brands that we can't live without. Let's get into it.
So?
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm actually just looking at your photo. Zoe Hardman turns heads in a leopard print dress and leather jacket. I mean, oh my goodness. I'm so glad that I'm getting these photos of you because I don't get to see you anymore.
No, listen.
And now I feel like I know what you're doing.
Let me tell you what's happening here, okay? Vogue Williams, the lovely Vogue Williams, who's been on the podcast, also a mate of mine, she's taken over Sunday breakfast at Heart. So I now do 9 to 12 and she does 6 till 9 in the morning. So the paps are like camped outside for her. And because it's lockdown and because they're bored, they're like, oh, we'll just come in a bit earlier and we'll get Zoe when she comes in. You know, there's no other news going on. And so now I can't go into work basically with unwashed, like dry shampooed hair with skinny jeans and no makeup. I have to wear like a full on outfit and do a bow tie and wear shades. And I'm like, Dawson's like, what are you doing? It's like 6:30 on a Sunday morning. I'm like, I have to these days.
Oh my God. I'm loving it. It's amazing though. And what, I've got one question. When they pap you on the phone, are you actually on the phone talking to someone?
I was talking to Dozer and they were waiting after the show on Saturday. They're there now both days. Anyway, look, I'm not complaining. It's quite funny. But sometimes they get you and you don't know. So you've got to make sure you're not pulling like a very kind of strange face with like some eyes shut and your tongue out or whatever. It's just, yeah, anyway. How are you?
I'm fine. I mean, I definitely couldn't be pap right now. I have got conjunctivitis in one eye.
Oh my God, is it Flygate?
I'm actually on antibiotics now and an antibiotic eye drop because I was running yesterday and I thought I'd been stung by a wasp. But it turns out a fly had got in my eye and it was about 8 hours later, the fly fell out of my eye.
That's gross.
And then I woke up with my eye basically like closed together with gunk. I mean, it is gross. Who knew? I thought you'd get like shin splints or, you know, a twisted ankle from running, a running injury. I was going to say coronavirus. Conjunctivitis.
Coronavirus, conjunctivitis. I once was on a run and a piece of plastic flew up from the ground, a tiny bit of plastic, and went into my eye and ended up having to go to Ifield Moor Hospital. And I had to wear a pack for 3 weeks.
Yeah. Who knew the dangers of running? Wowza.
Stop running, start eating more cake. How is all your exercise going?
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, now the weather's not so nice, it's so much harder, isn't it? Like, I am still running. I'll still go and run a few times a week, but that's pretty much it. Not a lot else going on over
there. I just can't wait for the gyms to be open back up again, whenever that is going to be. Already in October now, because I'm waking up and I'm definitely going through a slump of like not being motivated to do exercise. I haven't trained, what is it, Monday today? I've not trained since Thursday. And like I know that in 10 minutes we've got to start training and I'm like, I don't want to.
You don't
want to
do it.
Yeah. I mean, you do feel like that, and that's fine if you feel like that as well. You've got to listen to your body. But I think we always say, don't we, that if you do get up and do a bit of exercise, you do feel better afterwards.
Yeah. definitely. So much better to just get up first thing as well and get it done. And then that's you for the rest of the day.
And then the kids all right?
Yeah, I've actually got Gigi sitting on my lap and she's eating a cupcake. So that's all good.
Have you been baking again? Or have you been doing Betty Crocker?
Of course I have. Betty Crocker. Of course. If you look out the window and you see grey skies, know that Georgia is doing a Betty Crocker cake mix.
I had a whole short Isla this morning.
I saw that.
Yeah, I'm finding it really difficult. Not because it's boring, because I don't understand it. And it's like, I'm sorry, but anybody that's sitting there and going, I remember it all from school, are lying. Because,
yeah.
I mean, antonyms and synonyms, obviously that was a couple of weeks ago. Today we had to do a maths equation using millilitres from potions. And it was like adding up in your head, like, what's 13 plus 17? I was like, oh, fuck.
How old is she?
She's 7.
Oh my goodness. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that feels like a real lot. At 7, I don't know, but it sounds very tricky anyway.
Well, the worst part was when we were having to try and do the math equations on the side of the piece of paper, and I obviously got it wrong. This was on her homework piece of paper. So I scrubbed it out with pen, and she was like, no, Zoe, you're not doing it right. This is how you do it. And then obviously you have to take a photograph of it, upload it to this thing called Seesaw. So all of the teachers are going to know that her stepmom tried to do the equation and got it wrong. Oh, God, was like, maybe I'll do it next time.
That is a great way to get out of doing it. Really good way.
Thanks. But listen, we're going to get into the chat. We've literally just jumped off a call with this amazing lady. We really wanted to have a discussion around disabilities and having a disabled child for a long time, haven't we? But we really wanted the right spokesperson, the right person to kind of bring her voice to it. And Julie Neville has been very vocal, hasn't she, about the fact that her daughter Isabella was born with cerebral palsy. So yeah, it's such a fantastic chat. I feel like so lucky that we got her.
Yeah, me too. I mean, let's hand it over to Julie now.
Yeah, we'll get into it. So another day, another podcast in lockdown, and Georgia and I are both absolutely over the moon to be sitting down virtually with this amazing lady today. She is a two-time published author. Her last book, Authentic Spanish Cooking, came off the back of her living in Valencia for 3 years. She's married to the Lioness manager, Phil Neville, and has been for the last 20 years since they were teenagers.
Wow.
They share two children, Harvey, who is 18, and Isabella, who is 16. Today we are chatting to Julie Neville. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Lockdown all okay?
Lockdown is good. I was saying kind of in the warm-up before we started how my son is made for lockdown. I think he'd be happy to not left the house ever again. And I'm really lucky. My children are very, very close. They're close in age, but they're very close together anyway. So they do everything together. So it's been quite easy for me, you know, that they entertain each other and they hang out together all the time. They have the same interests. So that's made it really easy for me.
Is it not difficult? I always imagine it'd be difficult to have teenagers in lockdown because, you know, they want their own space and stuff anyway. They want to be with their mates all the time. Is it hard to tell them, like, that they can't see their friends and what the reasons why, and do they get it?
To be honest, you know, both my children would probably quite often choose to spend time with the family as opposed to with their friends when given the chance. So I'm quite lucky in that sense. We're a very close family and we do a lot together. My son, normally, he plays football and he trains with his friends every single day. Obviously not at the moment, that's, you know, he's isolating training. My daughter, she misses her friends more, but they've got all these kind of Netflix parties going on and, you know, Zoom parties every night and things like that. So that's how they stayed in contact. So to be honest, neither one of them have complained once, which is incredible, really, now given that I think we're in our 11th week of lockdown. So they've been brilliant, really. They've never complained. They've never asked to try and meet up with people. You know, I think they understand. We have, you know, that probably like most people, that the daily news updates on. And so they see it. They're old enough to understand it and the risks involved. So I'm quite lucky in that sense that, you know, they've just accepted it and got on with it, really.
And Julie, it must be so lovely for you having so much time with Phil at home. So I imagine he's away a lot.
Phil's normally away all the time. In fact, we've been together, you know, for 23 years now, since being teenagers, and we have never spent this time together in our lives. So, you know, I used to think the key to our happy marriage was that we probably never saw each other. You know, we've lived in different countries at times. And, you know, so when we were in lockdown, I thought, oh, this is going to be quite novel. And, you know, to be honest, we actually have got on really, really well. And I think he's still working, you know, so there'll be, you know, quite a large chunk of every single day where he is in his studio that he's got set up for his TV work, or in his office where he's doing all these Zoom meetings all day every day. But to actually have him here every single night and have every meal together as a family has been brilliant for us. And in fact, right now I can see out the window, he's playing basketball with our children outside, which he never gets time to do. So for him, you know, he's probably catching up on years and years and years of things.
Yeah, that is so nice. Yeah, really nice.
We're hearing that obviously it's been a really tough time for a lot of people, but the actual kind of quality family time that people are having together, we're just never going to get this again.
No, that's definitely true.
I need to jump in and say I cannot wait for my husband to go back to work. We have never spent this much time together, and now I know why we don't spend that much time together.
So, Julie, just to put it into context, George's husband is also a footballer and plays for Leyton Orient. So he's like busy and all the time away and stuff. And now George is at home with them. She's been with him since she was 17 as well. So,
oh wow,
yes.
Well, at least he'll have his pre-season training to start now. My son started his pre-season training, so he's got that schedule to stick to every day, which gives him a bit of structure.
That's good. Yeah, no, I know. I'm joking. I'm watching them play in the garden now, and it's nice. But I've got my fingers crossed. He's driving me absolutely bonkers, but yeah.
I think I will be glad for not being asked continually what's for lunch or what's for dinner, or, you know, I'm cooking these three lots of three-course meals every single day, and I don't think I've ever cooked. I love cooking, obviously, but I don't think I've ever cooked and prepped as much food in my entire life as I have done during the last 11 weeks for three big meals three times, you know, a day. It's crazy.
It is a lot. It is a real lot.
I just wanted to jump in here and just to kind of talk to you about why we really wanted to have a chat with you today on the podcast. We've been dying to have this discussion about with somebody who has been kind of outspoken about having a child with disabilities. Now, we know, we read your story, we know about your daughter, Isabella, but could you just take us back to that time 16 years ago when you were pregnant, and just tell us how the moment was when Isabella came into the world?
Okay, well, I was just almost 6 months pregnant. So my son was 1 year old. And I was almost 6 months pregnant with Isabella. And in the middle of night, Phil was in Dubai in a training camp with Manchester United. My parents, who I lived around the corner from, were at their house in Spain. So I was on my own. I woke up in the middle of the night and my waters had broken. Very quickly, I realised, you know, it was going quite horribly wrong. So I went to the hospital, and they managed to keep Isabella from being born for almost 2 weeks, really, which is a bit of a risky procedure, but obviously every single day we could keep her inside in the womb massively increased her chances of survival. Phil got back from Dubai quickly. He left his teammates to get back because when I did arrive at the hospital, they sort of said, you know, where's your husband? And I was like, he's working away. And that's when they said to me, he needs to go home right now. And that's when they start talking to you about the statistics of, if your child's born today, there's a very strong possibility it won't survive. So he came back and slept beside the delivery table where I was for 2 weeks. And then on the day she was born, I had something called placenta abruption, which is where the placenta comes away from the uterus, which the mother would normally hemorrhage, which I did, and it stops the flow of oxygen to the baby. So they had to get her out very quickly. And I remember at when it had started to go wrong that they'd lost her heartbeat. And the last thing I remember before they gave me a general anaesthetic to get her out quickly, and the last thing I remember was them saying, we've had no heartbeat for 4 minutes. And there was a clock above the wall in the theatre. And I looked at this clock and just before they put me to sleep. And I noticed it said 12:24 on it. And her time of birth was 12:26. It was that quick that they got her out. So she was in the ICU. And I didn't come round to see her. I was quite unwell myself, actually, after having her. So it was 2 days before I was brought round. And then I didn't actually know I'd had a baby, actually, when I came round. And by the time they'd sort of said, oh, you know, you've had a little girl, and they brought me a photo of her. But it was almost 2 days before they would take, I was well enough to go up to see her. And so she was in the ICU, and she spent about 10 weeks in there, in the ICU. And I would go, you know, when I could eventually go home, because it was the hardest thing for me was the day where I had to go home, because I'd left my 1-year-old at home, obviously, when all this happened. And at that point, nobody had ever fed him, changed a nappy, put him to bed. It was only me. You know, I was this real hands-on mum. I loved every minute of it. I have to say that after he was born was just the best year of my entire life. And then this suddenly happened, and you know, he was at home, wouldn't eat, wouldn't sleep, didn't know where mummy was. So I was really torn because I could go home before she could go home. And so she was two floors above the floor I was in the hospital. So the day I got to leave, it was the most mixed emotions, that I was so desperate to get home to Harvey, my son, who was one. And then I had to leave her behind. And it's the most, any mum that's been in that situation will tell you, it's the most difficult thing emotionally to deal with.
Yeah.
And so you leave with this photo of your baby. And so I went home and I had this photo of her beside my bed and her empty Moses basket beside my bed.
Oh,
and, you know, now obviously that, you know, we've been heavily involved in a charity to make sure that other parents can stay. But at the time, there was no provision for us to stay. So we did that for, like I said, 10 weeks, where we would I would go and spend time with her during the day. Phil would just carry on working. He was away a lot. And I would take my son with me every single day. And we'd do her little cares, and we'd scrub in, and we'd, you know, you had to open the little doors of the incubator and put your hands in either side. And then we did quite a lot of kangaroo care, you know, where we did skin to skin, which was lovely. But she was about 10, 11 weeks old by the time she could eventually come home.
Wow. And at this point, was there any indication that there was any complications with her health at all? Or was she treated as, you know, any other prem baby is?
Yeah, well, they said to me, because she was having lots of brain scans and lots of tests, and, you know, she'd had to have quite a few emergency transfusions and all of this, which, like many babies born probably as early as her, possibly have to have. But at the point when she came home, I mean, she's still under heavy care, you know, the nurses came every day. But at that point, they told me, you know, she would just continue to progress then, probably a little bit behind, you know, her age, because obviously her gestation wasn't complete. But she would progress like any normal child. That said, very quickly, I had the feeling that there was something not quite right. I used to take her to baby clinic every single week in her baby, but there was notes of me complaining about, you know, she was, you know, she failed all her milestones, but really badly. You know, she couldn't sit up still at 15 months. I noticed that even if I sat her in a car seat, she was slumped quite heavily to the left side. So I would be driving, I'd have her strapped in, I'd say to Harvey, you know, like, push Isabella up, you know, because she would be slumped to one side. I noticed that she kind of dribbled more on one side. And like I said, she didn't even sit up. She, you know, when you take them to baby clinic and they do, like, they have to pick up like little Rice Krispies, she couldn't do anything like that. She failed all her tests. And they kept saying to me, you know, because like I said, I went every week without fail, you know, stop comparing your first child to your second child. Every child develops at a different rate. Premature babies take quite a long time to catch up. You could expect that to take several years. And this went on and on and on. To the point of where I was going on and on and on about it. And my husband, actually, you know, we never fall out. You know, Phil and I, I'm more likely to cry than shout. And you know, we're very close. We hardly ever argue. But at this point, he started to sort of say to me, you're looking for things that aren't there. You're becoming psychotic over it. If the doctors are telling you there's nothing there, then just accept that there isn't. And this went on. And I remembered going to the clinic this particular day, and, you know, she was about 17 months at this point and still laid flat on her back. And she was getting very frustrated, you know, because obviously her mind was of the age of wanting to do things that a 17-month-old baby could do, but she was laid flat on her back.
Yeah.
And only could play with the toys for like a newborn baby, or you know, I would prop her up and carry her around, or, you know, all these things. And then the other thing I noticed was that, you know, her development in other areas was probably being affected, because what your parents will tell you if they've got a disabled child is that your children teach you to teach them. So if you have a child that's learned to walk and you're walking through a garden with them, you know, you would automatically say, don't run, or let's hop, or let's skip, or they'll pick a flower and you'll say, don't touch that, or that's a yellow flower. And all these things you are teaching them without you realizing that they are leading you to teach them that. But if you have a child that just lies down, you're not going to say to them, don't run, don't skip, don't go too fast, don't touch, because they can't actually do any of that. So I realized that she wasn't just not moving, but she wasn't learning, you know, things that, you know, I was missing out on all these things that I would naturally teach her. So I'd gone to the clinic, and they went and got the doctor, because I was getting quite worked up about her still not doing any of these things. And she also vomited every single meal. She choked continually on the slightest thing. So she was on completely pureed food, you know, which obviously at this age she shouldn't have been. And so I couldn't give her things to chew on or nibble, like she would just choke and throw up. And also she'd been admitted to hospital quite a few times. She would just stop breathing for no reason. She'd go completely blue, stop breathing. We would have to, like, 100 miles an hour, either in ambulance or in a car, get to hospital. And generally we would be admitted for a week. So I would move in with Harvey. Phil would normally be away. And this went on, like I said, till she was almost two. So this particular day I'd gone to the clinic. The doctor came and he gave me back exercises to do with her. And I got in the car and I drove to my mum's house. And, you know, I burst into tears to my mother and just said, look, I know everyone thinks I'm crazy, but I know in my heart that there's something not right.
Yeah.
I said, Phil thinks I'm losing my mind. I said, and, you know, I'm going back to clinic every single week. I'm not getting anywhere. And so my mother said to me at the time, look, you know, I think that there's no, you know, there's nothing wrong with her. It probably is everything the doctor's saying. But if you feel that in your heart, drive to where she was born, which was the specialist unit in the centre of Manchester. She'd go to the hospital. Go now, go and ask to see the top paediatrician now and force it. So that's what I did. I got in the car, drove to the hospital, walked in like some crazy woman because I was crying at this point. And so because they knew me because I'd spent so much time in there, they were like, oh, is everything okay? And I just remember going, look, no, everything's not okay. I know there's something wrong with her and I need somebody to tell me what it is. So when I got my obstetrician and I explained to him, and he was like, look, don't worry. It's probably nothing. Sit here. I'm going to get somebody to come and see you. They went and got this lovely, lovely paediatrician to see me. And we spent an hour with her. And when I left, she just said, I'm just going to run a few tests. But when I left, I remember ringing Phil and saying, they know what's wrong with her. And he said, what is it? I said, well, they didn't tell me what it was, but I know they know what it is. And he said, how do you know? I said, I just know. Mm. Anyway, she called me, this paediatrician, a week later. And she said, you know, I'd like to make an appointment for you and your husband to come and see us to get the results. And so I said, well, look, my husband's away for quite a few weeks now. So, you know, is it something you could tell me over the phone? And I was driving. I was actually on the way to nursery to pick my son up. And she just said, are you driving? I said, yes, you need to pull over the car, stop the car. So I stopped the car. And that's when she told me over the phone, she said, your daughter's got cerebral palsy. And I remember being in total shock at the time. So I remember thinking, and I actually said it to her, look, you know, I've heard of cerebral palsy and I have a vague idea of what it is, but I have no idea what this means for my daughter. And she said, well, you know, this is why we need to have a meeting, because every case of cerebral palsy will pose differently. And there's a full spectrum, as there are with many conditions, of you know, from the very mild to the very severe. And so we need to discuss about where we think your daughter is in that and what it means for her. And, you know, I remember I picked my son up from nursery and I got home and I rang my mother and my sister and said, look, I'm just ringing to let you know that the doctor's called and Isabel's got cerebral palsy, so I don't want anybody to come around. I'll speak to you all tomorrow. And they were like, oh, my God, you know, what if you lost your mind? I was like, no, I just need time to process it. Yeah. And I thought, if they all come around, I'll be bursting into tears. And I thought, right, I just need to get my head around this, then I can deal with it. And Phil, like I said, he was away. So I did what's the worst thing you can possibly do, is that you go on the internet, you look up, you know, about this condition. Obviously, the most highlighted cases will be the most severe cases. So I remember putting the children to bed, crying myself to sleep on the stairs, waking up on the stairs the next morning. So as soon as Phil got back from where he was with the club, we went and had a meeting. And, you know, there was a lot of doctors in this room at the time. And, you know, they explained to us that Isabella was going to have an MRI scan because cerebral palsy is a form of brain damage, and the MRI scan would give them a lot of information but wouldn't necessarily give them the whole picture, because they can look at 1,000 brain scans with the same amount of brain damage and every child will still pose different levels of disability. At this point in time, they couldn't tell us if she would have learning difficulties. She didn't speak. She didn't make many noises at all, actually. So they told us at that moment in time they couldn't tell us if she would speak or if she would say a full sentence. They said that they thought they were potentially going to have to fit a feeding tube, because, like I said, she vomited everything that wasn't completely liquid, and she was all, you know, 18 months old at the time. They said that she may never toilet train. They said that I asked the question. I said, look, will she walk? And they came back straight away and said, you know, she doesn't sit up, she doesn't crawl, and she doesn't stand. So why are you asking if she'll walk at this stage? And I said, because I look at walking as the key to leading a near normal life. And they said to us, you know, well, at this moment in time, it potentially isn't in her lifetime. So I remember getting in the car, going home and just thinking, oh my God. So, you know, what will she be able to do? You know, it was this meeting of, they told us all these things she potentially would never, ever do. So it was another one of those things. We got home, Phil and I, and we were like a bit in shock. In fact, he didn't speak about it. He just kind of acted like nothing had happened. And I was completely traumatized. So again, I kind of thought, right, I'm going to give myself 24 hours to feel sorry for myself here, and which I did. And then I got up the next day and I thought, right, okay, we just need to face this head on. And I had this kind of thing where I thought, well, if I accept that she's not going to do any of those things they said she potentially won't do, then she never will. But if I give her every possibility to try and achieve them, you know, then she might have a chance. So that was my mindset straight away. From the next day, I thought, right, come on, you know, what do we need to do? So I kind of immediately rang. They give you all these people from occupational therapists, physiotherapists, pediatricians, neurologists, you know, eyes, ears, you know, this, you get this whole team, which is incredible. This was all provided on the NHS. It's the most incredible service. And this team worked together. So they would all see her however many times their role is per month. And then once a month, they would come together and have a meeting and discuss the progress that was made in that month. You know, it's the most incredible service that they provide. And then I also I got a joiner to come to the house, and I put rails around the whole house, upstairs and downstairs, at her height. And then I went to like the local toy shop, bought all her favourite toys, and I put them on these rails, kind of read into it and learnt that quite a lot of the growth of a child is stimulated by the stamping movement of their feet.
Right.
So I thought, I've got to get her on her feet. So I thought, if she can stand up and hold onto this rail, I knew she'd want to get to the toy. So it was kind of almost like, well, I would say bribery. And looking back now, it potentially was also child cruelty on one level, because she was so desperate to get to these toys. And I remember I was stood at one end of this rail with the, you know, probably just half a meter away from her. So Harvey and I were stood at this with the toy on the rail, and she was stood up holding onto this rail, and she was crying for the toy. And I was saying to Harvey, don't give it to her. Do not give her the toy. And that's how it started. She would drag herself to get to the toy. And then Phil went away, and I got rid of his three-car garage. Didn't need that. And I made it into a big soft play area, because I wanted her to be able to stand up, fall over, and not get hurt, because her life was going to involve a lot of falls, and it has. And so we created almost like this sensory physiotherapy room for her. Which was incredible, really, for her. She could try and climb up these soft stairs and fall off, and it wouldn't matter, because she landed on a soft, you know, on a soft base. And that's how it started. And she can't continue with all these treatments. I have to honestly say, the first 3 years of her life, I look back and think it was just like 3 years out of my life. I felt like I was treading water, trying to keep, you know, stop myself from drowning. I was trying to put on this exterior, even to my husband, you know, that I can do this, I can still be the perfect wife, and I'm this mother, and it doesn't matter that I've got this child that needs all this help, and she doesn't sleep, she doesn't eat, she can't swallow, she throws up, she stops breathing, and all these things, and still be this great mum to our other child that was only, you know, two at this point.
Yeah.
And so those 3 years were, you know, particularly difficult. And I think the thing that was really hard for me, and you know, now I speak to it, and you know, I'm in contact with quite a lot of the parents of children with cerebral palsy, and I will say to them all that quite often you spend a lot of time, you know, 4 or 5 days a week in hospital doing all these treatments and feeling like you're getting nowhere.
Yeah.
And we did that for years. I felt that I was getting nowhere, and you know, at times I would sit there and I would cry myself to sleep and just think, you know, where is this going? You know, we're working so hard with the speech therapists and the physiotherapists and the occupational therapists, and it's scan after scan. And, you know, she was wearing, she had to have these splints on, which were plastic to her knee, with metal rods that went up her legs that fitted to a metal brace around her waist. And she wore that for quite a few years. And so you couldn't get clothes to fit or shoes to go on her feet or, you know, all these other things that come with it. And even just going out was just a, you know, difficult because she would probably vomit 5-6 times, but like literally projectile everywhere. So I would go out with bags and bags and bags of clothes. And, you know.
Yeah.
So we'll be back right after this.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Now, let's pick up where we left off with our wonderful guest.
They think that obviously cerebral palsy is when the oxygen is starved from the brain. They think that you had a stroke in your womb.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah, they do. Yes, they do. So only from the MRI.
Yeah.
The MRI showed that just before my waters broke at, you know, 28 weeks gestation, for whatever reason, which is an unexplained reason, which I've since learned is actually quite a common thing, there was a stop flow of blood to the brain for a split second, it can be. Yeah. And this is actually quite common. They said 1 in 400 at the time, 1 in 400 babies in the womb will suffer a stroke. Quite often, a lot of those are in the first 12 weeks. The mother may miscarry and there will be no explained reason at that time. There could also be quite a lot of children that have gone on and had strokes in the womb, but it would have been a milder effect. And you may go on and they might just never be the fastest runner. They might just never be particularly brilliant at maths, but they will never have severe enough symptoms to warrant an MRI scan or for further investigations because they're not left with any particularly severe defect. In Isabella's case, she has quite a lot of brain damage. So the fact that I've seen that scan and I've known it, she actually is a walking miracle that she's achieved what she's achieved and she is how she is today. And, you know, if somebody, you know, when she was born or 1 or 2 or 3 or even 5 or 6 had said to me, you know, she'd be like she is today, I would have given everything we had to guarantee she could be like she is today because I could just never visualize it. And, you know, I would say that, you know, yes, we are lucky. We're in a position where, you know, we could pay for extra physios. We could transform garages into play areas. We could, you know, do all these extra things that we do. We could pay for the best splints and you know, that she wears now to this day. They all help. I would say that she is like she is because of her, you know, because of her mental outlook and her determination and her, you know, this attitude that she has. And, you know, you said you'd seen the Good Housekeeping magazine.
Yeah,
and in that, I'm not sure if he said it in the article or not, but, you know, in the interview that I said that recently we'd had to go for an appointment with her surgeon, which, you know, is something that's ongoing, and she potentially facing a really huge, huge surgery at the moment, and, you know, we're doing everything we can to try and put it off or prevent it if we can, but, you know, there may come a time in the very not too distant future where she has to have it. And it would involve, you know, breaking her hip, breaking her leg, breaking her knee, breaking her foot, moving it all around. She would be wheelchair based for quite a long time. Then she would have to learn to walk again. And, you know, all of this, which, you know, for anybody is particularly difficult and frightening, but for a teenage girl, at this point in her life, and, you know, not just physically, but emotionally and socially, the impact that would have on her. And we talked openly with the surgeon. Now she's of the age where they speak openly in front of her. She needs to understand. She needs to be on board with it all. And so we had all these conversations, which were obviously particularly frightening. And we got in the car to go home. And she said to me, like very matter of fact, she just said, you know what, Mummy, I don't look at myself the way you look at me. And I was like, oh, I don't know what you mean. And she said, well, I sit in that meeting and I listen to you all talk about me and all the things that are wrong with me. And she said, but I feel normal and I feel strong.
Oh,
and
wow.
At that moment, I was thinking, first of all, don't cry.
Yeah.
And secondly, try not to crash the car. But that is her mindset. You know, she just said, you know, I don't look at myself as disabled. I know I am and I accept it. And it makes me who I am. But I don't look at myself like that. I don't see myself like that. She said, I feel perfectly normal. I feel completely strong. And then her next sentence was, and I'm not having the operation.
Really? Yeah.
That bit we might need to discuss at a later date. But, you know, and, you know, if that were probably my proudest thing with her is that she just, you know, faces everything head on. She's very strong-minded and very determined. And, you know, like going back to what I was saying, for 3 years I felt we were making no progress. And then literally she was 3 and a half.
Yeah.
And one day she stood up and she just walked.
Wow.
And like,
wow.
I was like, oh my God. And there was only me and Harvey there at the time. So I was like, well, I'm not going to tell anybody because I don't want my mother ringing every day going, did she walk again? And then her never do it again. And then a few days later, Phil was home and we were in the soft play area and she got up and she started to take steps and we were counting. She was going 1, 2, 3, and she did 15 steps and then she fell over. And her face was just like this. It was like this moment. It just, if I could have captured that moment, you know, if we'd have been as good with mobile phones as we are now.
Yeah.
And you know, I knew in that moment that she was going to be okay. It was like the moment where the penny dropped and everything, all the hard work that had been put in, all started to fall into place at that moment. So I always say to everyone, it was 3 years out of my life. And then from that moment, it was when everything started to progress. So it does eventually come together. You feel like you're getting nowhere, but it actually, under the water, it is all working. And then it just comes together.
I was going to ask, Julie, for anybody that's listening that's got a disabled child or who's got a friend that's given birth to a disabled child, and they're not where you are, and they're feeling, you know, probably all the things that you felt as well. What advice would you give to them listening?
Well, you know, the first thing I'd say is, look, you know, first of all, don't beat yourself up about feeling upset or frightened or worried. They're all the things that are completely normal to feel. And I felt them. I hid most of them, I have to say.
Yeah.
And you know, I look back now, you know, to times where during that time where, you know, it was the most traumatic 3 years, really, because obviously we had the traumatic birth and then everything was going on. And then to find out she had cerebral palsy and she'd had this stroke and then be thrown into this system of like literally 4 or 5 days a week of hospital, like virtually living in hospital for a few years. And trying to juggle being a good mum and a good wife and all those things. You know, it's okay to not feel like you're being brilliant and perfect or feel like you're not coping. And, you know, I wasn't open about that at the time. I didn't take them up on any of the offers of, you know, these groups or support networks because I just, you know, I didn't want to probably accept that potentially I wasn't coping great at the time. And, you know, I did end up, you know, having panic attacks at times, still not telling anybody, you know. So I look back at, first of all, I would say, you know, allow yourself to cry sometimes or to be upset or to be frightened. And for me, every time, you know, we got bad news, because, you know, with a child with a disability, quite often there is quite a lot of bad news. There is quite a lot of things to deal with and take in. And for me, I'd say, right, 24 hours, I can sulk about it for 24 hours and tomorrow we're going to face it head on. And to this day, that's what we do. And I'll say that to Isabella now, you know, okay, that's not what you wanted to hear. You know, you've got to wear, you know, she has to wear these particular new splints that we're just waiting to have fitted at the moment. So she's got 3 months freedom, really, because we can't get them fitted. And so I said to her, look, I know you don't want them. It's not brilliant. You can sulk about it tonight. And then tomorrow we don't moan about it again. And that's what we do. And the other thing I would say is that progress can sometimes seem slow, but there will be progress. And, you know, trust in the system and, you know, like I said, the NHS can provide some incredible people that, you know, work with these children and are amazing. And, you know, our daughter hopefully is a story of hope for so many, because her prognosis wasn't particularly great. And she's far exceeded every single one of her prognosis and continues to do so. And, you know, so she is an example that, you know, from a child that, you know, at almost 2 years old, literally was like having a newborn baby, is now a very bright and courageous and beautiful and clever young lady who goes to a very high achieving grammar school, who should have just missed it in her GCSE exams, and who's currently, as we're doing this podcast, is outside playing basketball with her brother. So, you know, that's what I would say. Don't give up hope. Allow yourself to be upset sometimes. Probably limit it to how long you allow yourself, and just have faith in the system and know that progress will be made, because it will.
And how did your friends and people around you react after Isabella's prognosis?
We didn't tell a lot of people at the time. I think that was probably more my husband's doing. He didn't want to tell anybody. We handled it very differently, if I'm being honest. So he, when we came out of the hospital after having the first initial meeting, I remember getting in the car, ringing my mother, crying, saying, oh, they said she might not walk and she might not do this. And then he rang his parents and said, yeah, they said it's nothing to worry about. Loads of children don't walk at the age of 18 months. It was like we'd been in two completely different meetings. And so that, at the time, I'm just thinking, you know, what is he talking about? Did he not listen to anything they said? And then obviously over the next few months, whereas I was doing all the hospital appointments, he was just carrying on going to work, and I was doing all the hospital appointments with both children. And, you know, Isabella was being plaster cast and, you know, all these different brain scans, whatever it was. And he never talked about it. And then I quite quickly came to realize that his way of dealing with it was just to act like nothing was happening. But I was fully submerged in it at this moment in time of, I'm giving up my life here to give this child the best chance of, you know, achieving a near normal life. And so we were on polar opposites of, you know, our understanding of where we were at that time. So this, I would say, probably went in for 12 months. We didn't have any crosswords about it. He just acted like nothing was happening. And I was just trying to stop myself from drowning and, you know, trying to cope with everything. And it was actually, we went to a mutual friend's child's birthday party. And at this point, Isabella was wearing splints on her legs. And, you know, she was quite obviously had something wrong with her. You know, it was obvious to anybody that would see her. But we didn't speak about it openly, you know, further than our immediate family. And so we'd gone to this birthday party, and the children's entertainer was playing musical Bumps. So Isabella was probably almost three at the time. So she obviously wanted to join in the party games, and she was like next to like a pillar on the wall. So, I mean, it was literally heartbreaking to watch, because all the children would be like dancing around. So she'd be holding onto the wall and bopping away. And then the music would stop. She'd hold onto the wall to try and slide herself down. But by the time she got down, everyone else was back up and started again. So then she'd then try and pull herself back up again. And, you know, it was one of those moments where, you know, I had a lump in my throat, but she was just working her way through it, trying to join in this game.
Wow, what a creeper. God.
Well, yeah, she must have been exhausted kind of shimmying up and down this pillar the whole time. But the children's entertainer obviously didn't quite know what to do with her, because obviously the children that didn't get down quick enough were out. So he never kind of told her, you're out. So it got to the end where there was her and this one other child that obviously won, and she thought she'd won. And then he gave the prizes to the child and just pretended she wasn't there, really. And so then she starts to cry. So that was that. So I picked her up, went and got her some sweets or something, you know, give her some sugar, that'll sort it all out. And that was that. It was all forgotten. We go home, bath the kids, normal routine, put the children to bed, and I came downstairs and my husband was crying. And it's very few times in the 23 years we've been together that I've ever seen him upset. And I was like, oh my God, what's happened? You know, I didn't understand what had happened. And he said, this is it, isn't it? And I was like, this is what? And he said, she's disabled. And, you know, I was had to stop myself saying, and you only just realise that now. But, you know, I was thinking, no, don't say that. That's not appropriate. And I was like, well, you know, it is. But, you know, I'm coming to realise that, you know, that doesn't mean she's not going to have a completely, you know, normal and happy and fulfilling life. And, you know, today obviously was just unfortunate. That game is something that she will struggle with. You know, the way I look at it is that she's, you know, I'm going to teach her. There's nothing she can't do. It might be a little bit more difficult at times, or we might have to do it in a different way. But, you know, I'm going to instill in Isabella that there is nothing she cannot do. And that was it. It took him that long, really, to just really see that, you know, she was disabled and that this was her life now. And then after that, he was much better. And at that point, you know, we hadn't come out publicly and said what was wrong with her. And we didn't do that, I think, for about another 12 months, where we came out publicly and said, just because we were getting so many, you know, requests of what was wrong with her, actually. And I just thought, look, if we come out and say it, it'll be, you know, old news by tomorrow. So we did. But our friends were amazing.
I was going to say, was it more of a, you know, a privacy thing that you wanted to kind of protect her? Or were you carrying any shame around her disability? Because there still seems to be a bit of a taboo. I don't know whether people don't know what to say, or people don't want to have a conversation. They don't know if they're saying the right thing. Is it going to upset? Is it the right turn of phrase? I mean, what do you think it is, Julie, that's still holding us back, I guess, to have more conversations around disabilities?
The thing for me at the start, why I didn't tell people, was really controlling my, it sounds so silly, really, because I felt if somebody came up to me in the street and said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear about your daughter, I would cry. And I didn't want to be, you know, what I would have felt at the time, looking weak or making a fool of myself in public with people I didn't know. So I felt, until I'm at the point where I can speak openly about it without breaking down, or speak about it and feel strong, then, you know, I don't want to speak about it. And, you know, I think my husband, he obviously just hadn't come to terms with it, or I don't know whether in his own mind he was trying to work out, you know, where was she going to be in the spectrum before we work out how we're going to deal with it. I'm not too sure. You know, I think now it's a different era now from when she was born. She's 16 now. And I think a lot of people don't talk about it because I think they're frightened to say the wrong thing. And I think even down to what's going on at the moment in the world of, you know, people standing up for racism, and, you know, quite often I don't say something because I'm worried that even though I'm trying to do the right thing and say the right thing, that I won't say the right thing. And in doing that, I would offend somebody. And, you know, so I think quite often it's just a lack of education. You know, my daughter now notices people stare at her, or, you know, quite often, even now, you know, people come up and say, oh my God, what happened to your legs? You know, when she's wearing these splints in her legs, that, you know, and she just says, oh, I was born like this. and then I can see she feels a little upset, but she knows that that person just didn't understand and they were not meaning to be mean or rude. That said, you know, there is still the people out there, the very small minority, that do find it completely hilarious to mimic how she walks behind her, or, you know, make fun, but she knows that the shame is on them. And that is what we teach her. You know, I think, like I said, going back to it, I think a lot of people don't talk about it because they don't want to offend or say the wrong thing. I would think, you know, a bit of ignorance maybe.
And for your daughter, like, from her point of view, would she rather, say she's meeting some friends and they introduce her to someone new for the first time?
Yeah.
Would she rather that person said nothing, but she knew that they were looking at her and wondering?
Yeah.
Or would she rather that they just outright asked her, you know, oh, what happened? And then she can explain.
Yeah. I mean, Isabella doesn't talk about a disability. It's not something she would naturally chat about because, like I said, she just says, I just feel normal. So, you know, she comes home from school and said, oh, they were asking for people to volunteer for the cross country, which obviously she can't do. And she's going, I've volunteered. And Phil and I both go, oh my God. You know? It's like, oh, what did the teacher say? And went, yeah, I'll put your name down. And I was like, oh, right. We might have to call the school. You know, but we love it that she puts herself out there and she does act normal. You know, she's had to go to 5 schools. We've had to move quite a lot with Phil's job. And, you know, each time she started a new school, she's found that particularly worrying and difficult, you know, in terms that she knows that quite often she goes to a very high achieving school. There are not many people in the school with disabilities. There are a couple with, you know, maybe a hearing disability or, you know, a dyslexia or something like that, which is a disability. But with Isabella, hers is largely a physical disability. That's the way her cerebral palsy at this moment in time poses itself. so, you know, she tends to be in the minorities in the schools that she goes to. The school she just started, which she started 2 years ago, over the summer, quite a lot of girls messaged her saying, oh, I've heard you come into the school. This is the world of social media now. I heard you come into the school and can't wait to meet you. And a few of them brought up the fact that I heard you have cerebral palsy. You know, what does that mean? And so she chatted with these girls about that. And I kind of stayed out of it. And, you know, she seemed fine with it. And I think she actually felt, actually, we've got it all out of the way when I'm not face to face with these people and I'm not on the spot. I can take my time with my answers. And that seemed to work quite well and break the ice. And then when she started, she seemed to settle in quite well.
Yeah, so it was all that, yeah, she'd sort of given them all the information.
Yeah.
All the questions were answered and then they could obviously just get on with their friendships and get on with their school time. Yeah.
Yeah, but if people do question her, she's very matter of fact about it. She wouldn't get upset about it unless somebody was mean or, you know, which there are, which does happen, you know, whether it be at school or in public, there are things that happen. And, you know, the day-to-day life as well at school is slightly different for her than for a normal child, even down to doing her GCSEs. You know, she chose food tech as one of her exams. So obviously there's things that, you know, they're judged on chopping and prepping and things like that, where it takes as well a lot longer to peel potatoes and chop onions than it would you or I, and there's more risks involved. And, you know, so there has to be the school and the you know, the charity, the hospital trust have to work together to make sure she can still be judged equally. And gets a little bit more time and things like that. But and to be honest, she doesn't want any of that. So we had to go for an assessment to see what she would need for exams. And when we went in the first 15 minutes, when they kept asking her, you know, would you struggle with this? Would you struggle with that? Which I knew she would. And she'd go, no, thank you. No, I'm good. And so like after 15 minutes, I was like, Isabella, you're going to fail all your exams if you don't tell them the truth here.
I love her so much. She sounds like she's got so much about her, hasn't she? What strength and kind of confidence. It's amazing.
She really does. She really, you know, if I say to anybody, if I had to worry about either of my children, it wouldn't be her because she's just so determined and, you know, courageous, and she really does just get on with it. So, and, you know, she has to have this extra time in exam. So when she got the letter saying she had this extra time, she just said, my first question is, if I don't need it, can I just leave when everybody else leaves? So I was like, you know, everybody else is like, can I have extra time? And she was like, I don't need it. I don't want it.
Amazing. Amazing.
You know, so yeah. But she's brilliant. She really is.
Sounds like you've like got done such an incredible job in raising such a strong, like, incredible girl. I mean, wow.
Well, I don't think it's down to her. I think it's down to her. I really do. Mm-hmm. She's made it easy for us with this outlook and attitude. And, you know, like I said, the first thing she will say to anybody, look, I don't want any special treatment. Treatment like everybody else, and that's what she says to her friends, and, you know, it is her motto in life, you know, just treat me like everybody else, you would everybody else, and I'll let you know if there's something that, you know, I can't do. Generally she won't, but she'd say that she would.
And I guess anybody that's listening, the whole, you know, when Isabella was nearly three and you just kept nearly two, and you just kept banging on the door and saying that something wasn't right. Yeah. I guess anybody that's listening that's got that mother's instinct, you know, don't give up, keep pushing. If you feel there's something not quite right, you need to really investigate that and make people listen, because you're often right, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the thing that, you know, my husband found quite difficult at the time was that I'd been going back to clinic every week complaining about everything from her, you know, not being able to swallow, to never sleeping, to stopping breathing, to not sitting up, to all these things, basically failing every single milestone. And being told I had to stop comparing the two children, and premature babies take a long time to catch up. Mm-hmm. And as it happens, if she'd have seen these top paediatricians earlier, they could have diagnosed her probably 12 months earlier, and she would have been in the system a lot earlier. You know, the way I looked at it at the time, my husband was really angry at the time because she'd almost slipped through the net, really, that I'd been banging on the door and nobody had listened. And he was really angry about that. And he brought that up in the meeting saying, look, you know, should somebody have listened to my wife? And they actually all said, look, you know, absolutely. Right. The test should have been done and the scan should have been done. And the way I looked at it was, look, you know, you didn't give her cerebral palsy. It's not your fault. Yeah. Maybe she should have been a little bit earlier, but, you know, now we know, so let's just get her in the system and let's start treating her. I didn't want to for me, there was no blame to be placed. Mm. It is what it is. She was born with cerebral palsy. She had a stroke for whatever reason that was, which we will never know. And that just created this, you know, condition for Isabella. So there was no blame to be placed. It is what it is.
Julie, thank you so much for coming on. What an amazing story, completely inspirational. And, you know, you sound like you've got an incredible family there. So thank you for sharing it with us. I really feel like you would have got loads of people listening today.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Oh, what an amazing lady.
Don't. She's incredible, isn't she? Like, seriously. I think when you hear people who have been through a journey like that and they speak about it in such sort of... I mean, she obviously did say, you know, the first 3 years were very, very difficult, but she speaks about it in such sort of a diplomatic and... I don't know, just a
pragmatic.
Very pragmatic, that's what I mean, not diplomatic, sort of way. And she's very matter-of-fact about things and... Yeah. It's just in awe of people like her, really.
Yeah, I am too. And also how she's raised Isabella and the strength inside her. You know, she said it wasn't down to anything, you know, exterior that we'd done. And, you know, we could afford the nicest splints and, you know, the soft play at home and all that kind of stuff. But actually it was Isabella's strength that kind of got her through. And
yeah.
You know, she was the one that got up and walked. And, it, you know, I guess you can either give up and think, well, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to my life. Or you can think, right, this is the card that we've been dealt. You know, my child's going to have an amazing life no matter what's going to happen. Some people are so strong, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think it's quite important to say, if you've got, you know, a friend who's, you know, maybe going through this and you don't know how to support her or him and they're not talking about it, then just sort of listen back to her conversation, because Julie and Phil both handled it very differently, didn't they? But they both did put on this sort of front, both of them, you know, for a long time, that they, you know, they didn't want to maybe talk about it openly. And I think it's good for people to realise that sometimes that is what's going on, and yeah. To, you know, just to deal with that accordingly, I guess.
Totally, that actually it's a process that they've got, that they've got to go through, that actually no amount of questions or caring or I'm sorry's or whatever else, it's actually they've got to get their heads around it before they're maybe willing to discuss it. So just hang in there and support your friends, you know, as you can, and also just people that you meet and stuff and people that you see. I think we're always, I don't know, it's a funny one with human nature. We have this idea in our head about what a normal, in inverted commas, child is supposed to look like, and actually that just, it's bullshit, it doesn't exist. It's everybody their own issues and own problems, and we have to support and love no matter what.
I just really hope that you know, some people listening will have found this episode interesting but also useful, if you do know anyone who's going through this sort of thing or you're going through it yourself.
Yeah. And we always like to give a recommendation of podcasts that we've done that are similar to the one that you've just heard. But actually, this is the first time that we've ever done a podcast about disabilities within children. But so we can't really tell you to go back and listen to any more. But we can say that we've got about 75 in the bank. So if you're new to the podcast, definitely go back and have a listen. All of the content is kind of timeless, and hopefully you'll get some really good use out of it. And
hang on, I'm just gonna put Gigi on the floor. She's at that stage now where she wants to be like, you know, like hand holding and walking around, so she doesn't want to be sat on someone's lap. But yeah, so when you are listening to the podcast, please tag us and let us know how you're listening. It seems like most people listen on their walks, I've noticed. Do let us know.
And you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast. That'd be really handy as well. And if you do get the chance to give us a little 5-star rating, that would be so lovely. And you can send us a message on my personal one, at Zoe Hardman or at Made by Mamas. And when are we back?
We are back on Friday with another great guest.
Can't wait. See you then.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We know times are very difficult right now. And if you want any more information about coronavirus, go to nhs.uk/coronavirus.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.